The guest today on In the Arena is John Bertrand, an iconic person in Australian sport whose life has transcended his own enormous achievements. He was the skipper of Australia too when it won the America's Cup way back in 1983. And sometime later, it was recognised by the Confederation of Australian Sport as the greatest team performance in 200 years of Australian sport. And to talk to him about the growth, the learnings, almost the audacity of what they achieved at that time was a big part of the conversation we had. But then to actually extend that into him in regard to the role he has since played in Australian swimming, where we've seen the rebirth, if you like, of a sport which is so much part of the folklore of our country. But I think the thing you'll find the most enjoyable from the conversation is he's now 77 years of age, and his thirst for knowledge and understanding, his curiosity is just, it's quite extraordinary. And I've had the good fortune of being in his company from time to time, but I've always felt whenever I was in his company that there was such a generosity in what he brought and his openness that it somehow felt that I knew him a whole lot better. And I think it's actually the very thing that you'll get from today. You'll feel within an hour or hour and 20 of this interview that you know and have met and had a conversation with someone that has had a real impact on you. So enjoy John Bertrand in the arena. We'll have as my guest here in the arena with John Bertrand. And I wasn't going to start this way, but I thought I would, because in preparation for today, I sat through twice and watched the Netflix, The Race of the Century. And I slowed it down just to get the very first comment of the whole show. Quote from yourself: "I've never met a world champion who is a normal person. You have to be screwed up in some manner to get out of bed and do extraordinary things, and I'm screwed up." So how, when I'm interested, firstly, your take on being screwed up, you know, yeah. What do you mean by that?
Just ask Raza.
Your wife? Yeah,
my wife.
Of how many years?
54 years. 54 like, years. That's a world record. No one ever achieved that. Particularly within the world of America's Cup. I say to people that, you know, typically they have marriages in that arena blow apart after 10 years into a million pieces. You know, that it's sort of not a normal lifestyle. But, you know, my reflection on that sort of comment, it's true. You know, to get out of bed, I think I've said that, didn't I? Get out of bed to do extraordinary things requires a different type of person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm chairman of the Sport Australia Hall of Fame. So I met a lot of screwed up people. In a nice, lovely manner, you know, and humble.
Yes.
It's really interesting. The supreme champions are humble.
Yes.
And my reflection there is that to get to the very top of your craft, whatever it is, you require the support and help by a lot of people. Mm. And if you're a dickhead, people don't want to be involved with you. You know, we see dickheads in the world of sport who get to a certain level, but they just don't go any further.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at the Federers and these people, and, you know, they are humble, they've got charisma, people want to be involved and help them.
Yes.
And that's my sort of observation is, you know, people like John Eales and these great champions, they are interesting, humble, driven people. You know, Ron Barassi, our mutual friend of years gone by, Ron was a friend for over 40 years with our family, and, you know, the most humble person you'd ever meet, scratched just below the surface, and there was an incredible mongrel.
Yes.
You know, his pride, his competitive pride was extreme. And, you know, I wasn't around really when he was at the top of his game so much. But, you know, he could change a match, not because of his natural talent, because of his energy and this whole feeling of force. So it's interesting. So, you know, I love hanging out with people who've been there either at the top of their game or have been at the top of their game, because typically they are really not only interesting people, but this sense of being humble as well, particularly in this country, in Australia.
It's an interesting change, isn't it? Because there was almost a sense at one point that the idea of humility meant weakness at one stage. Because there's also something else you say in the Netflix show is you talk about ego, and
yeah,
you talk about, you know, beneath the veneer, if you like, of and my experience of you, and you know, people will talk about, we don't experience someone's intentions, we actually experience their behavior. So I can only talk of my experience of you is of someone who is, you know, very, very humble. But then, you know, the term you use is underneath the veneer of being a normal, nice guy, I have a huge ego. Yeah. So talk me through that.
Well, again, you know, part of the drive, what drives people?
Yes.
You know, to win the America's Cup was not a business decision. It wasn't a good business plan. You know, you wouldn't suggest that to any person, because it was a one in a million shot. When you look at the history of that event, where the Americans had dominated for all different reasons, including the world of technology. But so there's a certain drive that's required, a lot of drive, and I relate a lot of that to just, you know, plain simple ego, that, you know, we can beat the bastards. Particularly taking on the Americans, you know, the United States. Raz and I, we'd lived in the US for about 8 years, different times. I went to MIT in Boston and then worked with the Americans in different areas. And, you know, they have a lot of self-confidence. You know, it's a big statement, but across the board, compared to us Aussies, on the surface, that is. But for the Australians, again, to perform, I think ego is part of the engine of doing good things, great things, and extraordinary things. Yeah.
So the ego sounds like it's a within, but you certainly see the importance of presenting yourself to the world as a humble person, in terms of, particularly I find, how you connect with people.
Well, it's not as if it's an intention, you know, it's just who I am. And generally, again, with my experience with, you know, the various other people who perform at a very high level, that's just the way they are. And as I said, you know, to get to a very high level, you need to help a lot of people. So people want to hang out with you. So I've never had a problem about, you know, building a team, for example, for people not wanting to, you know, be involved in things that I've been doing. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's hard to work with on the surface, an egomaniac.
It's almost impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard. Where it's I. I really don't like the word I within a team. You know, they say there's no I in team. And when I hear people, head of companies, CEOs, and say, I'm doing this and I've done that and I've done, I look back and I look at it and I think, not sure about that relative to, it's just as easy to say we, because these things are teams anyway. Okay, the CEO or the chair, you know, they have a vision or whatever, but it's still, everyone buys in. And if you're talking about empowering people, empowering organizations, I don't see where I fits into the mainstream dialogue there. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the lines I like on that is that it's all on you, but it's not about you.
Yeah.
So when you've got that responsibility, you're skipper of a boat, CEO of an organization, coaching a team, the responsibility sits with you. But when you start to make it about you, you've just slipped into a place which is not what a team needs in that.
Well, again, it's, you know, do you feel encouraged to be part of this thing, or is this a one-man show? You know, it's a pretty binary type of thought process, yeah.
Particularly with the America's Cup, because so much of the focus, there was obviously a lot of focus on Alan Bowen, there's a lot of focus on Ben Lexon, but really mostly with yourself. And how did you give credit, or how did you ensure during that time that there was just so many people involved in that process, wasn't it? I think even in describing the success, you said something like, you need good administration, you need good tech, you need a good team.
Yeah.
And team needs to be led, you know, needs a skipper in a real sense. So how do you, as a leader, ensure that you are giving credit in that way?
Well, again, talking about we, you know, it's pretty simple. Yeah. You know, everything's we.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing what you can get done if you give credit to other people, regardless of what you think internally.
Yes.
You know, it's not rocket science, this stuff. And if you're having an organization where you have a group of people who are empowered, and that's the way I see leadership of anything, then it's amazing what you could get done, you know, because the potential of a group of people compared to one individual is enormous. You know, the intellectual horsepower. You know, Ed de Bono, he created this concept of lateral thinking. You know, the phrase lateral thinking came from Ed.
Yeah, Barassi used to talk a lot about Ed de Bono.
Yeah, and Ed became a good friend of my, Raza and myself. We spent, when he came from the UK, you know, anyway, he used the America's Cup as a benchmark for some of his things, yeah. Anyway, he created Six Hats of Thinking, a book that's, you know, published many years ago. But it's primarily that, you know, the great breakthroughs of mankind, like the Trans-Siberian Railway, the technology to create such an incredible, you know, end solution, going through mountains and around and whatever, the breakthroughs didn't come from 1,000 engineers working together. It typically came together as a result of pods of people, up to 6 people, but no more. And, you know, the Skunk Works, the Lockheed McDonald Skunk Works, to create the stealth technology, that came from groups of small people. So where de Bono is coming from is these magic pods of people, up to half a dozen typically. You need all different types of people around, literally around the table. So you've got the chairman, the white hat, the six hats of thinking. The white hat is the person who endeavors to bring the various thoughts together and to empower the people around the table. You have the green hat, as he says, and the green hat is the creative, you know, 10 crazy ideas and maybe 2 could be pretty interesting. 8, you discount. Okay, but the 2 could be, you know, the jewel and the crown. You've got the black hat, who's basically saying, hey, that's fine, but we don't have the money, or we don't have time, or we don't have this, or we don't have that. So you need the checks and balances. You have the completer finisher hat, I'm not sure, it's yellow hat. No more meetings, no more bullshit. Just tell me what I've got to do and I'll get the job done. Okay, you need someone to actually make shit happen. So all of these interesting people, and people can have different, you know, combination of hats, skill sets, around a table, working as a super collaborative team, that's when magic can happen. And we saw that within our America's Cup effort. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to be involved in various things where you just get this magic happening. And it's because interesting people, all different interests and backgrounds and skill sets, are empowered. Now, there's no I in that conversation. There's no I. And that's the interesting thing I find. But to lead an organization, that you, on the surface, my opinion, you've got to be humble, such that people want to work with you. They want to hang out with you. And it's not just a 9-to-5 discussion. It's sort of the really intense things like the America's Cups and others. It's a 7x24 mindset.
Yeah, no, you've got to, you're buying in on that. If you're not prepared to buy in on what that thing is, you're almost saying, well, you can't be a member of us. You can't be part of us. And it was interesting because Dennis kind of talked about that actually in the Netflix series, in the Netflix show. What hat did you like wearing?
Oh, look, I'm typically a white hat. I'm a chairman type role where I'm in the business of empowering people. That's my skill set, and a visionary type thought process to the table. I enjoy over the horizon thinking. You know, not what's today and tomorrow, but potentially what's going to be the game in 10 or 20 years' time. I enjoy that sort of thing, yeah.
How did you get on with Black Hats?
Well, again, accepting that they're very important. You know, the people, you know, we don't have the money, we don't have the time, all that stuff. It's very, very important.
Yeah. They didn't de-energize you at different times?
When you say de-energize, it's just part of, you know, getting stuff done.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because strong-willed people, you know that understanding their role can sometimes find those people just almost like handbrakes inside. But you're saying, though, I to get the best from you almost, you need to have a handbrake, you need to have a black hat in your room.
Within an organisation, you need the checks and balances. Otherwise, you go off and you go broke.
Yeah.
Or you run out of time.
Yes.
Or you think, okay, lovely potential, but who cares about potential? We never actually succeeded in what we're trying to achieve.
And where did this come from for you? Because the one thing which really struck me about almost everything you've taken on, the word which kept coming to mind was audacious, that everything you've taken on, there's a sense of audacity about it and risk-taking. Clearly, you grew up with, you know, sort of the nature and nurture of your life in terms of sailing. But then the leadership piece comes for you. And Raza has an interesting line in it where she talks about the call within you. You know, there's some call within you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you sense that, or would that be an external validation of your what you felt?
When you say, did I sense it? Not really. No. You know, I grew up in an idyllic world. We down at Chelsea, outside of Melbourne, climb over the side fence of our house, where Mum and Dad actually rented and then eventually bought. We're on the beach, Chelsea Beach, and then you've got to have luck in life. And about a kilometre along the beach was the Chelsea Yacht Club. So that was we used to hang out there. That was our kindergarten. So we muck around with boats in summertime, never wear shoes, forget about no sun cream, no nothing. It's just a different world. And play footy in wintertime, you know, and try and do a bit of schoolwork in between, you know. So that sort of upbringing, it was kind of idyllic, and it was, you know, when eventually got to Monash University, I'd never heard of Scotch College and Melbourne High. I'd never heard of these places.
It just weren't part of your growing up?
No, I was at Chelsea, Mordialloc Chelsea High School, and that was my world, and then Chelsea State School before that, and the Chelsea Yacht Club, and racing sailboats or mucking around with boats, and then eventually racing. So my world was totally abstract. When I got to uni, I listened to all these people about what their fathers had, you know, who they were, and everyone knew everyone. Kind of just, you know, the Melbourne, which school did you go to? And that really got to me, to the point where, you know, I can show these people. It's kind of interesting. So that was kind of pricking my, looking back on it, you know, it's hard, you know, why have I been so competitive? And I am. In a nice way. I think that was part of this, you know, the fact that, you know, why do these people, why do they think they're so good compared to me from a totally different background, based on which school they went to and which school their father or their mothers went to, you know? So this inherited type of environment. So that really got up my nose. And so looking back, and motivation, I think, that I can prove that I can do stuff, not only for myself, but show other people what I can do. It's interesting. It's kind of it's an animalistic type raw thing. But that's as much as I can do, you know, sort of analyze in terms of. So I've been involved in projects, you know, Olympic Games was always a really interesting stuff. And got to two Olympics, won the bronze medal in a long time ago, 72 German Olympics. Sorry, the leather medal, fourth place. It's worse than last. It's just terrible. Nobody cares.
Leather medal? I don't think I've heard that before.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. I walked down to the ceremony with a Brazilian, a man called Jorg Ruder, one of the greatest of all sailors, double world Olympic fin class champion and starboat champion. And at any rate, he got the leather medal four times, four Olympic Games. And we walked arm in arm, and he said, John, you realize you've just won the leather medal, fourth place. So I went back, won a bronze, very proud of that. That was the 76 Montreal Olympics, East Germany first, Russia second, and and Australia, myself third. No coaching, no money, no nothing.
I think it was an Olympic Games. We didn't win a gold medal.
That's too, right.
It?
Yeah.
It was almost a turning point in Australia. Yeah,
my bronze, which is in the Australian Sports Museum, you know, I feel very proud about that.
Yes.
I think there was four medals in total.
Yeah.
In total.
Yeah. I think hockey might have won a silver, I think.
That's
memory.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, so, but anyway, it's crazy, the Olympics, you know why. And they went back again, 80, mortgaged the house. Ra's a part of that program. Then we boycotted because Russia invaded Afghanistan,
that's
which
right.
You believe, like, look at it now. And half the world, led by America and followed by Australia, yeah, certainly the sailing program, we boycotted. Swimming went and others, but a lot of controversy at the time. And then this crazy thing called the America's Cup came along. You know,
why is it an infatuation in the
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, you mentioned about you know, the higher calling, I guess. At any rate, is little Johnny Bertrand from Chelsea down on the beach, you know, 7 or 8 years old, mucking around with boats, dreaming about Olympic Games and then dreaming about winning the America's Cup. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. What a story. You talked about, and I hope you're okay me asking about this, the going to Monash and then hearing about Scotch College and sort of the old boys network and the dads and all that, because you lost your dad in your teens.
Yes, that's right. When I was 15, my brother was 17. Yeah, we didn't have enough money for the funeral, so we were broke. We had little soft toy manufacturing business, teddy bears and koalas, and Mum and Dad made these. Mum made the teddies and Dad would go out and sell them, you know, with his brown suitcase. I remember smoke like a chimney. In that era, if you had stress, the doctors would say take up smoking.
Yeah, prescribed almost, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a long time ago. So Dad died lung cancer when he was 50 years old. We had no money. At any rate, unbelievable. She invented us, became a businesswoman. Amazing. Didn't go to Harvard or anything like that. She just figured it out and able to create, reposition our little company, Burlex Toys, into something that was able to keep paying the, you know, for Mum, for myself and Lex to, you know, be at home.
Yeah. And I think you also mentioned your grandfather and your great-grandfather passed away at the same time.
Yes, on the same year.
The same year, yeah. And you talked about you lost all the men.
We did, yeah. So Dad died, then my grandfather died the same year, and in the same year my great-grandfather died, all in the 1 year. So it was, you know, for our little family, it was clearly a big deal. And my mother and grandmother were really, well, obviously the matriarchs and a huge influence on me, of course, yeah.
I get a sense there was a wonderful, you might remember him, a competitive little Richmond player by name of Kane Lambert, retired just recently. And when he retired, the question which was asked of him, because he went through a number of drafts, never got drafted, and kept you know, just created a career for himself, basically, and ended up having a terrific career. And the question which was asked of him was about proving people wrong. And his answer was, I'm just pleased to have been able to prove people right, you know, the people who supported me and loved me and cared for me.
I like that.
Yeah, and I sense there's a bit of that, both of those with you. There's a bit of proving them wrong in it, yeah. But it seems that there's a lot of love and support in your life
Enormous, yeah. You know, with the concept of boats, you know, when Dad was there, you know, they'd just bend over backwards if we really were really strong on something, he'd support my brother and I. And then when Dad died, you know, I had different people come in and you know, give me a boat to compete in a major championships and so on. So all of those people, you know, Peter Hosking, all these people, Ray Connolly, amazing individuals that just helped. Yeah. So you're right. So the support system, the backup has been remarkable and, you know, very thankful for that. And that's, you know, that's the extension of a team, isn't it? Where people, hey, there's something going on here. Let's give this a shot. Yeah.
And your competitor during that period of time, and he was almost like a black cap in Australia, was Dennis Connor, the skipper of Liberty, and who was the best in the world by or report. Were you a better sailor than?
Was I a better sailor?
Yeah.
Oh, he was multiple starboard world champion. I wasn't a world champion at that stage. But I think that perhaps I was a better leader, better organizer. It's hard to say, you know. But you mentioned about a black cap, but black cap is really one who sort of can't be done. He was just the opposite. He was a great visionary. He changed the game.
I was thinking more the black cap in, the black hat rather in the, the old westerns and all that. He was the bad guy. In the Australian yeah. eyes, we had you as the handsome Australian right. skipper and the right. yeah and the black cap. And there was a certain arrogance about it. And
well, that's he represented the US of A. That's right. Yeah. But really highly highly talented individual, very driven.
Yes.
The most Machiavellian thinker I've ever come across as well.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All different angles to win.
Yeah. Regardless. And happy to go there by the looks of things.
No problem at all,
Yeah, there's an interesting concept, and I don't know if you've heard it, with Pippa Grange, who's done a lot of work in psychology of teams and the danger of winning shallow and winning deep. my sense is you're a win deep person. You want to win for the right reasons. There might be a little bit of, pushing the rules as far as you possibly can, but from what I can see, he had no worries in winning shallow. He would do whatever.
Well, highly successful in the US of A. Yeah.
No excuse to lose, I think, or something like that was his book. And one of the things that you spoke about was that you were not mentally tough enough to take him on at that point. So,
well, in the early days, correct? Yes. Yeah. The 76 Olympics, as I mentioned, won the bronze. It 3 or 4 months after winning the bronze, again, as I say, I'm very proud of that, it became clear to me I could have won the gold medal just as easily if I had been mentally tougher.
Right.
And the point here is that and that was the introduction of, for my, great interest in the world of sports psychology, mental toughness and so on, to be able to perform when it really counts on the world stage, it became clear to me that was the action. You do your so-called 10,000 hours, your development curve's almost flat relative to the rest of the world. Anyone, within the Olympics, anyone can win, any 10 competitors or whatever. It's really between the ears at that stage. So, it's one of those things where there's no question that if I hadn't have gone through the trauma of of winning the bronze at the Montreal Olympics, if I hadn't have gone through that experience and then, it was really a kick in the ass of, hey, there's more to this game than just pure practice. My opinion, we wouldn't have won the America's Cup, if I hadn't have gone through that experience.
So what are some of the learnings you took or the techniques that you embraced in order to build that mental toughness?
Well, again, early stages, but, introduced the Carlton Footy Club at the time were premiers. Mike Fitzpatrick was the Rhodes Scholar, very smart guy, good friend actually. Dual captain, dual premierships, VFL in that era. And they were working with a man called Laurie Hayden, sports psychologist. Laurie, yes. So I, via Mike, I introduced Laurie to the team. Laurie wasn't accepted throughout. It was very early days. And sports psychologists still aren't accepted because they're talking about, they're seen as head shrinks in many ways. Certainly in the, we're talking about 40 years ago, but it was part of this project.
No, definitely in those days.
No. But, it's really, again, making the right decisions at the right time under extreme pressure. And that's really the differential between winning and losing in many ways. So it's this business in very early days, but the consideration of visualization and other techniques, which you start to, so that when you get onto the battlefield, onto the field of competition, that you're not starstruck and you can operate in not only a meaningful manner, but, the whole issue is to create your own personal best performance. Now, that's sort of, that's something that's evolving and still is. But in the early days, it was of great help to me. And for Laurie, for him to be a professional sounding board for myself, So as a leader, you know, as a team captain, I had, you know, various issues. It's lonely being at the very top, the reality, and to be able to bounce different ideas off Laurie and him come back. And it was an unemotional sounding board, a professional sounding board. That's the interesting thing. So a professional sounding board that was unemotional. And that was a great help to me.
It's something which I seriously encourage in terms of the work I do now is having people who they all have an integrity for the relationship. In that case, clearly he did, but also have an insight which is actually helpful. You'll find people who have integrity for you because they care for you and they love you and all of those sorts of things. But finding people who then can offer an insight beyond what you're currently thinking, because you only can bring one imagination to your own world, can't you? You know, you can be as curious as you like. You can be courageous with your learning. You can do all those sorts of things. But he's testing your imagination in some ways. He's creating a new force and a new focus. And then for you, though, it's one thing hearing it, but it's then having the courage to say, I believe in this, and I think it is actually helpful to us as a team. When you're probably looking at a group of people who are thinking, mate, where are you getting this stuff from? You know, where's this come from? How were you able to take that from, you know, a mindset where people were clearly dubious to something they then embraced?
Well, they didn't embrace it.
Didn't they? No.
It was too early.
Right.
So, you know, out of our team, our squad, like on the boat, 11 people, 12 people, a sailing team of 16, I reckon probably a quarter really started to go deeper into it. But in those early days, it was, this is all crazy stuff. But I'd been through the School of Hard Knocks. I'd been to the Olympic Games. I'd been on the world stage. Our other guys had not. So Colin Beachel was he wasn't an Olympian then. He was into the future. So I was the only Olympian there. And I'd understood the extremity of performing under extreme pressure. But without that experience, it's hard to, you know, suggest to people that some of these, you know, where that the mind is just as important as the practice part of it. So I think probably a quarter of the team picked up on it. And then that was fine. But one of the biggest important assets for me was an unemotional sounding board with Laurie.
Yes.
For my own benefit, for me to become a better leader, a stronger leader, and a more effective performer as the skipper and the captain of the team.
I think one of the terms you've used, I've seen written about you, is training the mind not to be intimidated.
Mm.
So tell me about that.
Well, again, it's this whole issue of making the right decisions at the right time. Now, if you're intimidated because of these external influences, US of A, the most powerful nation on world, or within the world of sport in this country, the number one competitor and all the reputation and the gurus and whatever, and your performance drops off. So again, this whole issue of being in the zone, in the flow, as we call it. We did a lot of, I've just retired as president or chairman of Swimming Australia, the Olympic program. And the Americans beat the drum on the pool deck at the Olympic Games. USA, USA, USA. There's no bullshit going on. This is real. This is America. This is the most powerful nation in the world. They've always dominated the sport of swimming as they dominated the sport of America's Cup. Breaking that apart and not being intimidated, this is just another world, okay? It's one thing to talk about. It's another to perform. We're not talking about Australian champions. We're talking about world champions, Russia, China, USA, okay? And for our swimmers to be on the pool deck, to basically eyeball them and not be intimidated, that's another world of potential performance. It's the same with our America's Cup, to be able to, at the press conference, I remember sitting in the audience, the previous America's Cup, and looking at our skipper, and I felt he was intimidated up on the with Dennis Connor, you know, Mr. America's Cup. And I felt that if I had ever had the opportunity of being the team captain of this America's Cup project, at the press conference on the stage with the world's press, the world's sailing press there, I was not going to be seen to be intimidated by whoever was on the stage against me. Okay.
So what does that look like for you? So that there's more than just, you know, head up, shoulders back in to do that. That's an intimidating environment by any definition.
It can be, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in most cases it is, yes.
And there was not a lot in your to suggest that was something you would actually become good at. Like at that stage, you were just an evolving leader during that time. But to have the observation to say, we look intimidated here, it's not going to be me if I have this opportunity. Was that just that? Was that a mindset thing, or did you train yourself?
We trained. So, you know, again, with Laurie, it was fun. But, you know, the way you shake an American's hand, who's, you know, let's say Dennis Connor, they come in a dominating fashion, hand over the top, okay? And us Aussies, you come in underneath, that's fine, half a step forward, rotate, so you neutralise the bastard. The first to blink is the loser. You never follow your competitor out the door. You always lead. You take control of your environment.
So it sounds like a whole lot of subtle, small...
It's body language.
Body language. You're doing the work here, aren't you? You're doing the work.
Well, you know, we practiced that. It was fun, you know?
Yeah.
And on the stage, Dennis blinked first.
What was blink first mean? What
does blink.
He actually blink. Blinked. Like as in blink. Like a physical blink. I thought you meant a metaphoric
not,
blink.
No, you do not blink. Eyeball to eyeball, straight down the barrel to the other person, and you wait for the other person to blink.
So it's like the weigh-in in a boxing, you know, two competitors staring each other in the face. Yeah.
Part of the deal. So all of these things, you know, it's all the subtlety of body language. You know, they say the suggestion is 70% of communication is body language, you know, and this whole business of being taking on the world and not being intimidated. Okay.
No, I think there's, it's interesting. You just got me thinking, I'm supposed to be interviewing you, but you got me thinking because there's certain things I think that happen that give you, you know, one of the misnomers is that we get our confidence by preparing ourselves really well, which is part of it.
Yeah,
no
absolutely
doubt.
It is. Because you've got to do your 10,000 hours.
Yeah. But that was your 10,000 hours happening that was a different 10,000 hours happening for you, wasn't it? To one thing, 10,000 hours as a sailor.
Is the preparation to get up to the world level, to be able to play the game. Yeah. That's right.
But you then your confidence is building whilst you're doing that. So you winning those little small battles along the way, as in who blinks first, is now your confidence is growing as well. Yeah. Adam Grant, I reckon you'd really enjoy his work if you haven't come across it. He says that, yes, confidence is a really good thing, but don't think you have to have confidence before you do it because you have your confidence by doing it and doing okay and the learnings and the growth which actually comes from it. Because I look at you now we're now talking 40, you know, over 40 years ago.
I've just competed in the World Championships in Perth three weeks ago.
Exactly. So you're top of your
I'm
game.
I'm still having fun.
Yeah. So, but that stage, you're very much emerging to actually go into that environment, which it just grew underneath you too, didn't it? Like it was this audacious bid, but all of a sudden you're a chance and it comes down to the very last race. Like it is the classic in using the Americanism of the World Series, the seventh game, you know, the seventh match. And there you are. And I think you got a minute behind. And my memory of it is, because the whole of Australia was awake, wasn't it? I don't know how many television sets or where everyone was, but...
How old are you?
So I'm 60.
Okay,
yeah.
So you were 20 years old.
I was 20, yeah. And because of Barassi, I was at Melbourne and Barass was the coach.
Okay.
So, and you'd had a relationship with him and been involved. And so there is this whole... I think the only things I think which I likened to it was Kathy in... the 400 metres.
Yes.
Maybe Kieran Perkins, I think.
Lane 8 was incredible.
In his race. The Matildas, I think, captured a lot of that in, they didn't go all the way and win it, but they certainly captured a nation in the way that they did.
Yeah.
But this was a sport which basically no one had, there was a very tight group of people who had a deep interest in. I think we all grew up with this idea of these cheating Americans who kept winning this race and we were non-competitive, it was a, but then all of a sudden we're a chance and it's the seventh race. And my memory of it is something along the lines of, we got a minute behind, but everyone was actually being very critical of you and something that you did early in the race. And it was almost as though we would have won it if, but then we win it. Yeah. So what would be your reflections had we not win? What would have happened to you if the seventh race doesn't pan out the way that it does and you don't win?
What would have happened to me?
Yeah.
I would have continued on.
Gone again.
Yeah. Now, it would have blown apart our marriage.
Yeah.
Because, there's no way that Raza and the Raza could have held it together. Look on reflection.
That's a big trade-off, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, I didn't, it's just one of these things, the craziness of it. Put it in perspective, we're over there for 7 months in America, in Newport, Rhode Island, because we had to compete against the other nations to gain the right to challenge for the America's Cup. So we had to beat the French, the Brits,
like
the Italians.
55 races or something like
that. Yeah, the Italians, the Canadians and so on.
Yeah.
And so we worked basically for 7 months. We had 4 days off in 7 months. In other words, 7 days a week working on this project and 4 days off. Like it was like a battle environment. It's like the soldiers in the Ukraine now, It's just a totally different world. So the intensity was massive. If we had have lost, I would have kept going. That's the mindset. Until we'd won. So it's just a matter of time. That's the way I saw life. Now, as I say,
it's an every 4 year thing, though. It's not like you're not buttering up and going next year.
No. So, but that would have destroyed the marriage. It's a tough gig, this whole thing. And let me say, if I, with a more balanced mindset, would I've continued on? I don't know, but at the time, when you say if we had lost, and it was, it was 4.5 hour race, and it was 43 seconds between first and second.
Yeah,
and it wasn't much.
And you've come from a minute behind, haven't you, in the last period of time?
Yeah,
or close to a minute. Yeah, understanding my memory. and then you bring all of this. This is your sport. This is what you've grown up with. And then Swimming Australia, as you mentioned, finds itself in a place that perhaps it never thought it would, in the with enormous swimming tradition, obviously, in Australia. But coming out of an Olympic Games, I think we won one gold from memory, but there was a lot of other elements to it. And you receive the phone call or you put yourself up, whatever it is, you come into the sport as the chair. And I read somewhere that you consider it as the achievements of swimming in your time there. You think of it as at least the equivalent of what you achieved with the America's Cup. The thing which is, in fact, I'm really interested in as part of that is that you come from it as an outsider into, not as an Olympic outsider, but into as a swimming outsider, as a chair where, you don't have your hands on the levers like you do as the skipper of a boat. Or tell me about your approach. Oh, first of all, let's talk about the achievement. What was actually achieved? Because I know you measured it often in the swimmers' PBs as almost the best measure in some ways. Just talk us through the actual achievements during that period.
Well, the team won. It was dysfunctional. So the 2012 Olympic Games, one gold medal. Magnussen was silver. He's seen as a total failure. Silver, missed out by a hundredth of a second. Give me a break. But putting it all, it is what it is. And I was asked to get involved. Initially, I said no. I don't know nothing about the sport. I have no swimming background. I have a high performance background, but eventually, I thought yes, let's give this a shot. It's of national importance. There's really two. The America's Cup in hindsight, was of national importance in significance of what happened with this country. The swimming program and the cricket program are of national importance. So when they eventually the board asked me to consider being the new chair, then I thought, let's give this a shot. Very rarely do you have that opportunity in life, okay? So for better or worse, I said, yep. What I brought to the table is a vision of, and this is fundamental to our America's Cup, and I had credibility. So the point is, even I came out from left field, left side, have no swimming background, but I had the cred of winning, of being the skipper, team leader of the America's Cup team, which quite a few of the coaches were old enough to know the significance of what we achieved. You know, the Confederation of Australian Sport voted the Australia 2 victory as the greatest team performance in the last 200 years of Australian sport. Okay, so that type of thing carried on, which was great. And I could walk into a room and I had no knowledge of all the politics of who's trying to kill who within the world of swimming.
It sounds like there was a bit of that going on.
Oh, my God. They're in the business of eating themselves when required. And it's just for whatever reason, they're highly political. And anyway, I got involved and I brought a vision of what the game will look like in 20 years' time. Let's get there faster than anyone else in the world. And just so very briefly.
So that was the vision?
Yeah, it was. And was based on the consideration I've been through three Olympic campaigns, but participated in two Olympics. You see, every 4 years, which is the time between Olympics, you get an improvement in performance. Throwing a javelin, 100-meter sprint, doesn't matter what. You take any 20-year period of the Olympic movement over the last 140 years of competition, modern Olympics, every world and Olympic record is smashed over 20 years, you know, from 1980 to 2000, 2000 to 2020. You look back on it, you think, why is it so? So all we do know is in 20 years' time, based on history, the game will be much further progressed than what it is now. So it's a very, very simple concept. Let's get there faster than anyone else in the world. Let's take our blinkers off of, we think this is world best practice at the moment, world best practice. We think we know that is, like, that we think that is. But all we do know is in 20 years' time, it'll make today look like a joke. That's the exciting thing. And that's exciting for young people who have no fear because they have no experience. It's a beautiful thought, okay? Older people have lots of experience, fear of it can't be done, all right? All these restrictions, a little bit like the black hat top world. So the America's Cup was a vision of what is the game going to look like, and let's get there faster into the future, over the horizon thinking. And the other element that I learned, you know, as a result of failures, four separate failures before we won the cup, is a value proposition of trust, okay? Of a culture of trust based on integrity and honesty, transparency, you know, family values, respect for each other, having fun, okay? Transparency, honesty is really important. It's easy to talk about, to talk about trust, but that's the essence of a team, in my opinion. And I is not part of that. That's the point, as I mentioned before. So I brought that to the swimming program. When I started to talk in these terms, the coaches, the first presentation I gave, they stood up and clapped. They thought, bring it on. Who's this jockey from outside? Okay, he's got this cred called the America's Cup. We get that. They're the type of things that we want to aspire to. And that was really, you know, I look back on it and it was very, and I just kept hammering this, you know, people just to ad nauseum. But it's this whole issue of empowering. So our coach, for example, Jaco van Linden from Holland, when I first met him before he was appointed, I had dinner with him. We started to talk about the future. And as he said, John, freestyle was invented in 1928. It was called the Australian crawl. Now it's called freestyle. He says, we don't know what freestyle will look like in the future. And I thought, he's our man.
Okay? There's a lot of courage in that too, because you you're coming from this long tradition of great Australian swimmers, and I'm sure a lot of great Australian coaches too in that way, but to look outside of the tradition of the sport as an Australian patriot, you know, the patriotic aspects of it, and probably a patriarchy as well in some ways. I remember when that appointment was made, there was a fair bit of pressure on you, wasn't there, at that time?
Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah.
I enjoy pressure, though.
No, I sense that. I sense that there and is I, a, and, I, and, you, and you're happy to absorb it too. That's the,
well, as Raza said, if I'm not living in a pressurized environment, whatever it is, I'm bored.
Yeah.
Just who I am.
Yeah. Bit of nature nurture. I remember actually even, you know, in the great Barassi, when he was, you know, the interviews which came up when, you know, on his service, the first thing he'd always say is that I was born with a strong mind and a strong body, you know, and then he'll take whatever credit comes his way beyond that. But he also reckons that there's a fair bit of genetic and support and love that he got. And then it's an interesting notion around trust, because the way you describe it then is, often think of trust now as an outcome. If we do those things that you talk about, we end up with an environment of trust. And I can say, even in, you know, my own time in sport, is that if there was one objective in the whole thing, is how do we become good at trust? Mm-hmm. You know, if we become good at trust, where everything else is now a chance, you know. And so having, you know, even with the work I do now, I actually say, can we have a strategic objective just to be good at trust? Like, because we know that we can do things to get better at it. You know, who we let into the room, for example, who we keep in the room, is one of the core elements of how we build trust. If you and I work well together, build a relationship, you know, we can have the sorts of conversations that we know we need to be able to have. And my from what the study I've done, or the look I've done, is that a lot of people didn't stay in the room. You started with 55 or 60 or whatever it was, and it was only, I think, 5 who saw the journey through. So when you talk about empowerment, do you start from that position, or do people have to earn their trust to get empowerment? I'm interested in what comes first for you in that sense.
I don't know the answer to that question. I think, you know, again, I guess through my lens, it's this whole issue of, you know, setting up an environment where trust is just part of who we are. You know, it's what we are. It's what we stand for. And if indeed trust is broken, then it's a major, major problem. And can you change those people? Well, some cases you can, revalidating. Other cases, you just, you know, you've got to let them go, you know, within the organization, because it could become cancer if there's, you know, undermining or white-hanting or, you know, all these different things as a result of politics. But I think, I don't know, I think, you know, the part of the scenario is, you know, what drives us? It's a sense of vision. The vision, incidentally, has to be exciting.
That was a great vision, by the way. Look, I didn't make the point at the time to actually just say, let's bring the shadow of the future forward. Yep. Let's just bring what the world can actually look like into our domain. Let's make it a 5-year thing, not a 20-year thing, or whatever terminology you use.
I tell people, all I know is I don't know.
Yes. You come from the position as an unlearner rather than a...
Well, I'm constantly curious. I want part of, you know, an organization. I want curious people. Most people stop asking questions when they're 13 or 14 years old, generally. Big statement. Then they start talking about themselves. Happy to talk about themselves, okay? It's those people who are constantly asking questions, learning, because life's a journey. Life's a learning journey. Like Raza, God bless her, when she's home, she's reading books and she's got little tabs in all different parts. I was having a look at one of the books she's reading yesterday. I said, why have you got these little tabs? Oh, I like to be able to go back. And she's just graduated from Monash University. She's 77 years old, studying China, Japan, and the Middle East politics. You know, but why? Because she'd never been to uni. So she wanted to, you know, and all their family had been to university. Like, so part of our marriage is she's constantly learning. I've got constantly fascinated by her interest in everything. And I guess that's, you know, I guess my mindset too. So anyway, the point is that, we, you know, within an organization, we talk about trust, we talk about a sense of curiosity, okay? Those types of people, though, I want to hang out with. because when we won the cup after all the effort, and again, that was our fourth cup in a row. We'd lost three in a row, right? So we've been beaten up by the Yanks each time and bid farewell. When we got to the top of Everest, our Sporting Everest, and I remember literally in my mind, for the first time I could see 360 degrees. So I took myself out of the cocoon of tacking and jibing and, you know, the micro of wind, water, competition as a competitor, one competitor, to the macro world, just kind of, you know, in my mind, crazy mind. And I could see for the first time about the fundraising, the politics, the boat designs, because I have a heavy engineering background, extensive, and all these different areas to pull together a very, very complex project. And it became clear how much work there is into the future and where you could go with these types of things. So I was perhaps for the first time really looking over the horizon. And it became clear to me how little I knew. And here I was at the world champion, okay, unfettered world champion at the top of my game, an America's Cup game.
Yeah.
And it became clear to me how little I knew.
Next to Bob Hawke, you're probably Australia's most famous person in that moment. You've just worked out that you don't know much.
No.
It's a wonderful
and then observation. The point is, you know, and I look back, so we're talking about 40 years ago. Where we are now, these boats are now sailing at 4 to 5 times the speed of the wind. We're sailing at 0.8 times the speed of the wind, exactly. Right? We're at the top of our game then. Okay, the rules have changed, God knows what. But the use of the internet and computational flow dynamics and, you know, the sports psychology and all these different things, it's just much further progress. The exciting thing is, where will the game look like in 20 years' time? It'll make today look like a joke. We're not just talking about America's Cup. We're talking about business. We're talking about sports teams. We're talking about life in many ways, the utilization of technology for a start, artificial intelligence. My God, we're just scratching the surface.
No, you talk about your curiosity. My sense is there's courage embedded in it as well. There's a curiosity to learn. So if you pick up a tidbit of information, we're having a conversation and I can see you lean forward into a conversation. I can see you lean forward. People have probably told you that before. You've got a lovely openness about you. But you get a little one of your brows goes up and you'll have I'm really interested in this. Yeah. But
now you're interesting.
Yeah, I've sort of captured your attention. Yeah. So but then there's a courage to do the unlearning. Because there is certainly a sense that things would have served you very well, which aren't going to serve you well going forward. And say, for instance, something like politics in swimming is probably often embedded in a practice of this has served us well, but you know, you're saying, hang on, it's not serving you well now. And that I think is a very underestimated aspect of growth. Not just the curiosity, but the courage. And the interesting thing, and one of the questions that my first question I ask people in job interviews is, have you ever taught yourself anything?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't care what it is. It's like Raza and her tabs in her book. That's self-directed learning. No one's asking her to put. She's probably going over and above what the natural expectation of the program is, what the course is, or whatever. There's something which is embedded in just a self-learner, and that goes to the heart of coachability, and which I happen to think is the number one attribute you can ever ask of any of your people is the person coachable.
Yeah.
And it seems that that might be a little bit of a almost a, if you're not that, you're not a part of my team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although if you aren't that, we might just have you part of the team just to play that role in the team, but you're not a long-termer for us in that sense.
Yeah. Well, if you're putting a team together, the objective is to go, you know, obviously to implementate, but then to move over the horizon. In other words, take this thing to another level.
And that's the vision coming through. And you, it seems to me that, and so part of the America's Cup piece, the vision that you either had or learnt or grew or created, then in many ways informed the Swimming Australia experience. And then the goal is to make it compelling enough that people in the room, they make a choice, either they're in or they're out. Mm. I'm part of this or I'm not.
Yeah.
And then over time, it's their actions which will indicate whether they're serious about it or not.
Yeah. So when we started with Swimming Australia, within the administration, we had 55 people. Within 2 years, 5 people were left. Change was too much for them. The politics was too hard. There's too much blood on the water.
When you say politics, as in, because if you're just setting up expectations and people aren't meeting expectations, I don't necessarily describe that as politics. See, I think of politics as people undermining or not aligning themselves with the vision. Is just explain it.
Which was the latter.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, yeah. The naysayers, the whole thing. You know, yes. People bitten, people tired.
Yeah.
It was time to move on. A lot of generally they were relieved to be moved on.
Yeah. Sometimes and just timing for people, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. You know, right. They just cycle, whatever.
Yeah.
And bring in fresh blooded people who energized and a buy-in into the organization. And similarly with the coaches. Initially the coaches would never talk to each other. Why? Intellectual property. If you tell some of your secrets to someone else and the performance of that other squad improves, then people migrate from your squad to theirs, and that's your business, you know, that's your livelihood. So the question of building trust between the coaches so they could compare IP, very basic stuff, for goodness sake, you know.
Yeah.
As we know, amazing, you get a group really. Of people.
It's, yeah. Yeah, we're on the same team, aren't we?
Well, no, it's survival, yeah. Each yeah. of their own silos of, you know, self-survival until... And, you know, the reality is that our competition is China and Russia and the US, not each other. So that was a big thing to get across. So this, again, this concept of trust and buying in on a vision, that the vision is taking on the world and we're going to leapfrog what's going on. It's, it's a different type of mindset. And primarily, without that momentum, very, very little progress is ever made.
I love the concept of buy-in, I must admit. I think it's almost the most important measurable. You know, is this person, you're in the room because of your coachability, yes, but are you buying in on the vision? Are you buying in on the leadership? Are you buying on each other? Are you buying in on this thing bigger
there's
than
a,
you?
There's a lovely line, you know, are you on the bus or not?
Yes.
We're not sure where the bus is going.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're all on the bus
on
together.
The bus, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll figure it out.
And sometimes you have to, and sometimes the vision does. We do need to plant the flag somewhere. There's a light at the top of the hill, and sometimes we climb the hill and go, actually, there's another hill.
I was the chairman of a company which we launched on NASDAQ in America, in the late 90s, a sports broadcast company in partnership with NBC, broadcast company over the internet. We're in the business of changing our direction every 3 months.
Yeah, you would have to have been because the technology was changing.
Game was changing. It was in dial-up. We're in the business of entertainment.
I was CEO of AFL.com during that period of time, and we're still just starting to try and get games.
Yeah, what's the business plan here?
Yeah, and we didn't know. People would actually ask you as though you knew the answer to the question.
That's it. Yeah. So, you have to be pretty brave or whatever, crazy, stupid, to be in that game. You know, is there a future? Do I have a future? But the point is being... based on market intelligence and so on, we're navigating ourselves. The bus was changing. Hey, that's pretty exciting stuff.
How did you know you were on track?
Revenue's coming in.
No, I mean, say with the swimming, more with the swimming. You've made all this change is happening around you. If you're going from, 55 to 5, that in itself is taking up a lot of time and a lot of effort. You know, just trying to find 50 good people to replace the 50 who aren't going to be part of the plan. This idea of how do you remain, how do you stay on track when you're trying to do something as big, which I know there's swimming happening all the time, but the measurable is going to be in 4 years' time, or actually, as it turned out with Tokyo, it was 5 years' time in that sense. So how would you have known during that period that you felt that it was progressing as you would?
Well, the litmus test of at the Olympic Games every 4 years, what's the medal count? It's pretty.
Is that your measurement?
Well, ultimately it is. Well, if you're talking about the cold hard facts, So we went from one gold to three gold to nine gold and 20 medals in total.
So there's massive improvement under any measure in that.
Massive. It was, in fact, then by Tokyo, it was the most successful swim team this country's ever produced. So nine gold and 20 medals in total represent more than 50% of the entire Olympic program of all sports. Yeah, so it was a big deal. But interesting enough, we moved, and we moved from the medal count syndrome, which is coming out of the Rio Olympics 2016, to personal bests. We were talking about this before. And that's this whole issue of forget about the pressure of the team achieving so many medals, etc. All we're asking is for our athletes to achieve their own personal best performance. And that's something that that's tangible. I know what I've achieved in the past in terms of 100 meters or whatever my event is. And I'm just in the business of doing my own PB. But the point is, on the world stage when it really counts. Okay, that's the difference. Not in a backyard pool, well, not backyard, but Olympic pool, but off away from all the pressurized environment. And so one of the uplifts we did, and my initiative here, and it's the only time I'll use I, incidentally, but I, through my friend Rick Burr, who then became General Rick Burr, Chief of Army, he introduced us to the commandos, to Commando Regiment and also SAS, in terms of not the physical, but what they go through for their mental preparation. So this is really this is a bridge from Rio into the Tokyo Olympics. Not everyone picked up on it. It's a little bit like all those years ago with the sports psychology. But some did. Some of our athletes who had been through the school of hard knocks, this is the point. Very hard when someone's fresh, have no experience on the world stage. I know everything, okay? These kids, you've got to lose before you can really build up a knowledge base to some degree. Anyway, some of the swimmers picked up on, some of the athletes, but some of the coaches really started to get into what these high performance people in military special forces were doing, okay? And possibly, so that was one of the influences that we had leading into the Tokyo Olympics. And possibly the best way I can explain it is you're on the starting blocks of the finals of the 100 meters, let's say 100 meters freestyle. And our competitor gets up on the starting blocks, and our person sees the crowd. So he has three 360-degree peripheral vision of my environment, no intimidation. We talked about that before. He understands that there's 1 billion people with a B watching. He understands that, okay, but not intimidated. Now, this is the dream. It didn't happen all the time, of course, but our dream going into the mindset was this is the scenario. He's able to bring his heartbeat down to 130 beats per minute from 180 based on the adrenaline through resonant breathing and visualization and so on, okay? This is special forces. It's how they operate, okay? That person now moves into the world of slow motion, into their flow, as we call it. Sports, there's so much discussion now on the flow, being in the flow. So everything becomes slow motion. AFL footy, one of the slowest men on the field is Pendlebury, and somehow he carves time and space out of nothing. A twist, a turn. This old man, how does he do it? But he does it, okay? So it's a beautiful thing to watch, like a ballet dancer. And we studied the ballet, incidentally, Queensland Ballet. These are supreme athletes as well from between Rio and Tokyo. The gun goes, right? This is the dream, okay? The vision. No, not the vision, the dream. The gun goes, 0.5 a second reaction, which is world class. Generally, 0.55 is world class. 0.5, just broken the world reaction. Yes, okay. And whatever it is, 5 strokes of the first 50 meters, tumble turn, 6 strokes on the way back, the last 20 meters, no breath, right? All the way through. Our athlete has just broken, smashed the world and Olympic record. He gets out of the pool. He says to the coach, how easy was that? And in addition, I cannot even remember the race. Okay. So in that environment, we're now talking about personal best. He's just smashed the world and Olympic records, right? He happens to have won the Olympic gold medal, but that was a side benefit. Mm-hmm. And this is part of our dream, you know, now the point is it happens sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of our athletes said, how easy was that?
Again, you're just in so many ways, what you're doing is, so it's one of the core element of some of the stuff I talk about is, okay, what does the role expect of me? You as chair, coach. And the answer is always create the conditions, and you define the conditions. So create the conditions which enable, you know, that athlete to swim faster than they've ever swum before. And there's unbelievable complexity in that. And almost the measure isn't the gold medal. The measure is, did he get in the flow? Because we know that if the flow is achieved, well, there's a good chance the other stuff.
If you've done your 10,000 hours.
If you've done everything else.
Brutal preparation. Yeah.
And so even in, because I coach, I mentioned I'm coaching Michael Voss, and the interesting thing, my sense, when they lost 6 games in a row last year, I was getting the same person as when they were winning 10 or 11 games in a row. That's the stage of life he's at and where he's thinking is in terms of his coaching. And the key thing was always often the perfectionist, and I think there might be a little bit of perfectionist in yourself versus the progress you're making. So perfectionism versus progress is one of the interesting scenarios, I think. Which way do you – my sense is you've probably fallen to the perfectionist side of life a fair bit over time.
Very much so, yeah. I'm sort of on the edge. What do they call it, you know?
Yeah, there'd be some we'll call it the Bertrand edge. We'll give it a name. But all the things you talk about actually relate to progress. Like bringing forward the future is progress. Bringing forward, you know, bringing in people other than what you would expect, you know, whether it's, you know, sports psychologists, when no one had sports, or very few people had sports psychologists, bringing in the army. It's interesting, when I was at Fremantle, we did a lot of work with the SAS there, and that was the thing we gained from them. The interesting thing they gained from us was the training that they were doing was injuring all their soldiers. And so all their soldiers had osteitis pubis because they were doing that traditional run-up sand dunes and all that. Well, osteitis pubis hurts just as much when you're in the SAS is what it does when you're playing on Subiaco Oval or whatever it was at the time. So we're able to get, there was a real mutuality in regard to that. So, and how old are you now?
Me?
Yeah.
77.
I think you're still in the progress business. You know, you're still someone who's got this energy for learning and you and Raza would have some really, just the two of you just sitting there over dinner, you'd have some really cool conversations, I would think.
Well, I'll never stop learning.
And I think...
And I'm proud of that.
Yeah. It's almost a sense that you're never full. It's like there's still another thing. And that's what this is almost about, is creating something for those people who feel like, certainly you do, and I'd like to think of myself in the same light as a learner, that there just might be someone who's listening who just goes, yeah, I'm going to write that one down. I love that little line, or I'm going to seek out someone in my life who can be for them how people have been for you and you have been for others.
Well, I hope so. I hope, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here if we can't, you know, excite a whole bunch of people to get off their ass to do wonderful stuff.
Yeah. And it might be in the end, that's what it takes. Like even on the coachability mindset is, you know, the first thing I say, are you up for change? So if someone approaches, are you up for change? And if they're not up for change, we can't take it anywhere. And the second one is, are you up for feedback? You know, is there any, because we need to inform the change in some shape or form. The third one is then, are you up for action? Are you going to do anything with it? You know, what changes here? And the fourth one is there's got to be some layer of accountability sitting within it, and personal accountability in regard to it. So as the chair of Swimming Australia, just as a thought which comes to mind, how did you keep yourself informed in a place where, you know, one of my favorite lines is, no one tells a CEO their baby's ugly. You know, it's one of those, how do you get feedback? How were you making sure you didn't lose the room? That, you know, that Pete, you, there's no point you going down this compelling vision if there's no one there with you.
In hindsight, again, the world of learning, you've got to have champions within your organization.
Yes.
You know, on the same page throughout the organization, not just at the highest level, who are empowered and confident enough to give you really no bullshit feedback.
And you'd seek it out? You'd ask them?
Yeah, exactly. And also the naysayers, to neutralize those naysayers. The best advice I had, a guy called Peter Morris, the last America's Cup, I was concerned about one particular guy. He had a lot of influence in the team, and he was negative in terms of his, you know, way he saw the world. And so how do you handle that? And as Peter said, go, you know, have a coffee with him or have a drink with him. Ask for his help. Okay, so that person, is he going to change totally? Probably not. But he's empowered to, instead of white-handing, to perhaps become neutral, hopefully more than neutral, being positive to the team, asking help. You know, hey, now, Harry, the fact is that you have a lot of influence in this organization. You know, your natural leadership style is great. I need your help because some of the feedback is, to be honest, it's not helpful, this sort of thing, you know, being honest communication, honest conversation. And I need your help for this project if we're not going to waste our time here, okay? So, again, my experience is you need the people who are give unsolicited, not unsolicited, but, you know, unfearful, advice, and also to have people who are, if they're not on board, to get them on board. Otherwise, you've got to move them on. In a high-performance team, we're talking about.
Yeah, you do. And I think it's interesting because I had a conversation recently with someone who said, one of my highest performing people is a bully.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question is, you might have a broken measure of high performance if that's the case, because you're only measuring one domain of high performance. They might be selling a lot of stuff. But by having clear understanding of what your expectations are in regard to that, that a person who's a bully could never be considered a high-performing person in that sense. So even having those framings. Mate, this has been a pleasure. This has been great. I'm so chuffed. Did you have a question of me? Was there any little thing that you thought of? You asked me before how it was going and those sorts of things. Any little thought comes to mind in any conversation?
Well, how are you going to syndicate this globally?
Globally? Yeah. Well, the good thing about the podcast platform is that it almost does that, you know, for you in some ways. No, we're going
to... But I mean to say the financial model is still unclear unless you break through and you need a, in terms of embedded advertising and whatever. You need to have a pretty big base to get some decent revenue, strong revenue, such that this is a real business opportunity.
Yeah, and it might well be that. The interesting thing is that it doesn't it actually is ticking other boxes for me in many ways. One, it puts me in conversation with people like you, so I get the opportunity of learning. I get to share those conversations with people. And one of the things that I say, we talked about Ron Barassi before, is I remember having a conversation with him where I found a piece of meaning in it. The conversation was, I asked Ron, what does he look for in a player, or what makes the great players great, was the question. And he couldn't answer the question. Bruce couldn't. So he took out a notebook and
wrote it down
and started writing down the names of the great players.
Oh, okay.
And he couldn't find anything in common with them. And almost in an act of frustration, he said, I think the great players are better than human nature. That was his...
Better than human nature.
Yeah, they've mastered some part of their human nature. They've worked harder, tried harder, learned more.
Yeah.
Because human nature, you know, I often think about people and growth, is there's normally two things which pull us up, either fear or lazy or some combination of both. And Brass was obviously neither. And so this idea of being better than human nature, and I was only about 19 or 20 at the time, I really love. So every time something pulls me up, I say, what part of my human nature is drawing on it? And often it is lazy, or it's a preparedness not to put myself into a place of risk or something. And then about, and this wouldn't surprise you at all knowing Brass, and then about 5 years later, I reminded Brass of this story, which I've in the meantime told however many people, and I now talk about it often in the speeches that I give. He had not one memory of it in any shape or form. He had no memory of having even the conversation with me, had no memory of even saying better than human nature. He did lean forward and say, that's not bad, isn't it? You know, he did give himself a little tad of credit. And so the long-winded answer to your question is that I often find that the work we do has an unknown meaning for an unknown person. We do not know what people will find meaning from the conversation we're having now, and being okay with that. And so it obviously complements the work I do with leaders.
One of the probably a mentor of myself, a guy called David Forbes, he's since passed on, probably the most gifted natural sailor that this country has ever produced. That's right. Fantastic. Olympic gold medal in 72 in Germany. In the star class, which is probably the most competitive of all the classes, and I said to him one time, David, why you talk to all these other competitors and so on, and you're giving everything that you've seemingly everything you've got. And he said, the more you give, the more you get.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit parallel in where you're coming from.
Very much.
David was constantly, he's just so open, and as a result, the conversations were very open for all these different people around the world that he was, communicating with. And that's a beautiful thing to have, yeah.
And that's really where it comes from. And there might be something else which appears at
but
some
time. But you've got to make some money as well.
Yeah, it
very
does.
Important.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, definitely. And it's and the work I do really is, this is a complement to it, because I coach CEOs basically, or coach coaches, or coach CEOs and their teams.
Yeah.
And so the conversations we're having now would have – yeah, with so much value for them.
I understand that. I get that.
If I had access to this, like so many, it's that time. The interesting thing you mentioned before about, say, young people and not being, because they don't know what they don't know scenario, they might make themselves accessible to, say, the military that wonderful learning. There's a wonderful line from Matthew McConaughey, the actor's book, Green Lights, and he says, There are angels of truth everywhere. We just don't tend to access them unless we're fucked, is the line.
Unless what?
Unless we're fucked.
Yeah.
We tend to, to access the wisdom.
Yeah.
When something. And one of the things that great coaching does, and particularly, and again, say with Ron Barassi, he saw something in me I'd never seen in myself. Because you only ever bring one imagination to your own life. And he got me doing recruiting. That's how that came about. And that just opened up my whole world. And I think if we can be compelling enough in what we bring, even to someone who doesn't think they need the thing at that time, and I certainly didn't think I did, that's the beauty, I think, And just definitely picking up the pieces for people, or helping people when their back's out of the wall, or they're really struggling, there is that element to it. But I think there's a wonderful thing when you get to engage with a group of people who mightn't think they need what you've got, but then find that they do, and they can take it to a place they never thought they could. And so it's been an absolute pleasure having you here, John, and mate, it's a great honour. Thanks very much.